Well, while this is pulling up, so in 15 minutes, I'm going to go through the interactions, and I'm not going to get into all the theory. We might have some time for it. But just to reiterate the importance of what Terry talked about, and Terry is the best in terms of talking about these issues that really, it amazes me how little we've come in terms around the education and knowledge around herpes. So just a personal aside, a good friend of mine who was entering into a new relationship with a physician, turns out the guy had herpes, never disclosed it to her. She acquired herpes, had a severe outbreak, so it was no question in my mind, based on a lot of different things, that this was a primary episode. Went and saw her OBGYN. She doesn't have any children. She hopes to be able to be pregnant. So one, she has a partner who's a physician who didn't disclose. Two, she wasn't offered suppressive therapy at the right dose for early herpes. Three, she was told by her OBGYN that she can't deliver vaginally, period, ever. And it was sort of like, wow, we really have a lot of work to do. And it really disturbs me that we haven't made more progress with disseminating this information. So I am concerned when we talk about sort of drugs going off patent and becoming generic. There's not a national plan that's forward on herpes. We don't have really support around national education except for forums like this and this sort of preaching to the choir. So I think we need to actually meet and strategize again about how do we move this agenda forward and really move it up. If we're talking about sexual health, herpes needs to be part of it. Okay, so syndemic. I'm not going to read all of this to you, but what we're talking about is this relationship between herpes and HIV in which one facilitates the transmission or acquisition of the other. And in the case of herpes and HIV, they really co-facilitate both. And this has led to, we think, to ongoing transmission. I'm going to spend some of the time just going through some of the epi data on this. Very busy slide talking about the relationship. And it's not just about the ulcers. I think the thing that we really now appreciate is that our focus on disease with herpes has been sort of a mistake. A mistake because we didn't have the knowledge about it, but also a mistake about what's actually happening from a biology standpoint. This is a disease of continuous shedding of virus, upregulation at the mucosal site of the genital tract of immune receptors and cells that facilitate HIV acquisition and transmission. If you look at, and we'll touch on briefly, the failure of suppression of herpes and impacting, to a statistical sense, HIV acquisition and transmission, it's because we have imperfect therapy that doesn't completely shut down viral replication, even if you reduce the number of outbreaks. And so we really have to move past the idea that it's only the outbreaks we focus on. It really is that this is a continuous low-grade replication that occurs throughout the genital tract, and all of the things that are on here really facilitate both acquisition and transmission of HIV. If you look, though, at genital lesions itself, you can find that you do bump up the amount of HIV that is present in a lesion. So this is just looking at an old amount of data, looking at a genital lesion due to herpes and what happens in terms of HIV and HSV detection. And you can look at what happens both in terms of the plasma and the lesion. And what we'll focus on here is that once you start treatment and you get the lesion to clear, you wind up getting a reduction in RNA in the lesion. Interestingly, and there's been repeated data to show this, that suppression with any of the antiherpetic drugs seems to actually have an impact on plasma viral load, not to a large extent, but there is now thought about maybe in resource poor settings or folks who aren't ready to start on antiretroviral therapy, if they have herpes, that suppression of their herpes may have some added benefit in reducing the progression of HIV, and something that, given we have generic drugs, is relatively cheap to do. Hunter touched on the epidemiology of herpes. It's even more prevalent and more of a problem in HIV-infected populations. So if you look at different subsets, you can find that overall about 60 to 70% of HIV-positive patients in the U.S. have HSV-2 infection as well, and it's much higher for certain groups, obviously minorities, women, heterosexuals, it's quite high. What, again, gets missed in all this and where we're having a hard time with HIV clinicians to understand is that even in this setting where you have more frequent severe outbreaks due to immunosuppression of HIV, the majority of folks don't know that they're infected with herpes. And in our clinic, we looked at this. Prevalence rate for herpes in women was 96%, and for men it was about 70, 75%. 80% of all the patients had no idea that they had genital herpes, none. So I really think, again, we need to get HIV clinicians to screen for STDs, and even though several of us, and Anna and I, were on the committee recommending herpes for the Department of Health and Human Services recommendations around opportunistic infections and HIV. We got a very watered down recommendation around herpes serologic screening. And I just think that we're not done with this. We really should be saying, look, doesn't make any sense anymore to do some of the tests that we've been doing in the past. We do CMV serology up front for screening folks that are HIV infected, yet with heart, we find very few people going on to develop CMV disease. The one thing that we know is linked to disease and transmission, HSV infection, HSV2 infection, very few HIV clinicians screen for. So we really do need to, I think, bring this forward. What's the risk of acquiring HIV and the impact of HSV2 on HIV acquisition? Bertie alluded to this. HIV negative patients, if they have HSV2, it increases their risk of acquiring HIV. If you're HIV infected and you have HSV2, you increase your risk of transmitting HIV. And certainly HIV can worsen the manifestations of HSV2, both in terms of increased shedding rates, as well as increased frequency and severity of the outbreaks when they do occur. Now, if we look at the rates of HSV2 shedding in patients on heart, because the belief for a lot of clinicians is, who cares if they have outbreaks, we just suppress them. If they're on heart, they're fine. Well, what we forget is that in normal adults, you shed virus even if you're not immunocompromised. So why do we think that people with HIV, because we put them on antiretroviral therapy, we fix the problem around herpes? What is interesting is you do see a reduction in the frequency of lesions that's statistically significant, but in terms of shedding, even though there's a reduction, it was not statistically significant. So part of my concern is that for HIV-infected folks on antiretroviral therapy, if you reduce their outbreaks, again, many of them believe that they're not at risk for transmitting herpes to their partners. They think, my HIV is below detection. So we have serosorting, and we forget that, well, gee, you're not serosorting probably for HSV2 because people don't know their status. You wonder why we see ongoing transmission of HIV within young MSM. A lot of this has to do with there's little knowledge or understanding about other factors and other STDs that facilitate HIV transmission. If we look at meta-analysis for HSV2 increased risk, and this was a wonderful study by Freeman, you can see that multiple studies, all of them really show the same thing, that HSV2 increases the risk of acquiring HIV. So if we look at this, and one being sort of no effect, the studies that were looked at, the median is to the right of the line, and even where you have crossing over, you only have one or two studies here that show that. If you look at adjusting for this a little bit more, looking at studies conducted in men from the general population, adjusting for age and sexual behavior, again, you can see that you have an increased risk. So the increased risk associated with HSV2 is about 2 to 4-fold. And it may not seem like much, but when you're looking at high prevalence rates of HSV2 in the population, it has a very large attributable impact. So if we take that information and look at it again, you can see the relative risk here for men and women is around 2 to 3-fold. For MSM, it's less, and that comes up, why is that? If you expect that herpes may contribute, you sort of diminish the impact of herpes because of the high risk of transmission associated with anal intercourse. So it's not that herpes doesn't have any impact, it's just that you have other factors that facilitate HIV transmission. Either way, in all three groups here, we see HSV2 facilitating an increase in the risk of HIV acquisition. Relatively small percentages or numbers in terms of looking at risk, 2 to 3-fold, but when you add that or amplify it based on the prevalence rates, you find that the percentage of attributable HIV can be quite high. So again, we cite Anna in lots of studies here. Looking at the data and looking at population attributable risk, for MSM, again, looking at the US data, about 35% of new HIV infections every single year we can attribute to being related to HSV2. For African Americans, it's about 35%, and overall, it's about 19%. So, significant impact. If we look at other studies and look at the probability of HIV acquisition, and we take, and I didn't cite all the studies here, it's just some snippets here. If there's a history of genital ulcers, you can see that you've got an increase, obviously, in terms of risk per, and this is looking at it per coital act. So these numbers look small. The larger the number here, the increased risk. The bottom line is that if you look at HSV2 positive serology, history of genital ulcer or not, you find you have about a 7- to 8-fold increased risk of HIV acquisition in this one study. It matters when someone acquired their herpes in terms of the risk. So if we look at young men, young women, where their sexual risk within networks puts them at higher risk for HIV, those folks that are newly acquired for herpes really should be counseled, especially MSM, that they are at increased risk for HIV acquisition, at least for the next 6 months or a year. Good reason to offer suppression, even if the studies that we've looked at haven't shown any impact, and as I'll get into, on suppression from a statistical standpoint around HIV acquisition. But certainly the knowledge of this, I think, is something we're not very good at disseminating. So in this study, recent infections increase the risk about 4-fold, prevalent infections about 1.5, and if you look at no HSV2 infection, that was the comparison group. So who's at risk? Individuals with HSV2 have an increased risk of acquiring HIV, as I already said. There's a higher HSV2 seroprevalence within populations that facilitate HIV acquisition. And if we break that down, you can see what that is by group. What about HIV positive patients and the impact on HSV2 on HIV transmission? If you increase the viral load, which we know it does, you increase probably the amount that you see in general secretions. With reactivation and inflammation in the genital tract, you increase the amount of HIV shedded in general secretions. All of that facilitates HIV transmission for someone who is dually infected. If we look at discordant couples, you can see what the transmission rate is from men to women correlates with viral load. So the higher the viral load, the higher the risk of transmission. However, if you adjust or look at what happens with HSV2 infection, you increase the viral load, not dramatically, but enough that it has an impact on a population level for transmission. If you go back and look at the same study and look at a history of genital ulcers or not, in these populations, you find that having a history of genital ulcer, and almost all of these were due probably to HSV2, not due to syphilis, again, strikingly similar numbers, about a 4-fold increased risk. Well, remember viral load, and we talked about the comparison for transmission. Taking that same study and looking at genital ulcers and the impact that that has on transmission based on HIV viral load, you have higher rates of transmission with a lower viral load. So the impact here is that you do see facilitation of HIV acquisition and transmission. What about the clinical presentation? Increased severity. I won't spend time on this to say that anyone who comes in with persistent mucosal lesions, you need to think about HIV infection. Anybody who has a new diagnosis of herpes should have an HIV test done anyway. What about HIV itself? We know that you increase shedding. We've already talked about this. This is sort of a slide that's a little bit difficult to look at, but the point I want to make here is that the total percentage of days of shedding shifts to the right, meaning more days associated with being HIV positive than being HIV negative. If we look at asymptomatic shedding again for MSM, higher percentage days of shedding being HIV positive compared to being HIV negative. And if you look at shedding rates based on CD4 count, not terribly surprising that the lower the CD4 count, the more positive days that you find HSV2 present. So what are the guidelines recommendations? Bottom line is we've taken sort of a soft pedal approach. I still think we're not strong enough in recommending that all folks who want to be screened should be screened, but in particular being I'm talking about HIV, my view is that every single newly diagnosed HIV infected person should have HSV2 serology done. It changes how you counsel, even if we're not going to affect treatment differently. Certainly having someone who doesn't know they have herpes now knows that they have it with HIV may increase, I think again we need to have more studies around this in terms of use of condoms, disclosing status to partners, and maybe even consideration of going on other therapies. So let me finish up very quickly on what I think has been sort of cold water thrown on the field, but hopefully we can generate more interest in saying, look, the issue's not closed. And that is, what do we know about HSV2 and HIV in terms of treatment? If we look at acyclovir suppression of HSV2, the bottom line is it had no impact on HIV acquisition, meaning folks who had HSV2 were suppressed, and we follow them to see if they acquired HIV, you see in both of these studies, and this is a little bit hard to see, no impact. And what's amazing, if you look at these Kaplan-Meier estimates, and this is true also for the CONVERSE study, really no impact at all. If we look at acyclovir suppression of HSV2 on HIV transmission, meaning someone who's dually infected, and we looked at their partners to see about HIV acquisition, again, this is more recently published, no difference. Even though in this study they found a reduction in the frequency of genital ulcers and shedding, so we think that suppression was working. But as Terry's already alluded to, suppression only reduced shedding by about 8%, which is pretty important. But given the complexities in the biology of transmission of HIV, may not be sufficient to see a reduction in transmission. So in finishing up, I don't think we're out of the woods yet around herpes and HIV in terms of what we should do. I worry that every time we have negative studies around the impact of STDs and HIV transmission and acquisition, the HIV field says, well, we're not going to put any more money into this, and we're going to ignore the fact that STDs facilitate transmission of HIV. I do think that serology and knowledge is important. It changes how we counsel, it changes how we approach folks, and it should be incorporated into HIV care. The last part is that the treatment recommendations are different, and you can look this up in the treatment guidelines. So when you look at what's there for HIV negative folks, again, my view is if you're going to treat someone, go with suppression first. Certainly if someone's HIV infected, yes, we worry about pill burden, but if you lay all this out there for someone who is not in a relationship with someone else who's HIV positive and has herpes, we should be discussing suppression up front. So in summary, HSV2 is helping to fuel the HIV epidemic. It increases the risk of acquiring and transmitting HIV. HIV can worsen the clinical and subclinical manifestations of HSV2, even though we didn't talk about that much. Testing is still important, and really we're still talking about screening, not so much testing, meaning looking at only folks with symptoms or reported history of herpes to confirm that. For HIV positive patients, we really should be offering screening. And patients at risk for acquiring HIV, this must be incorporated into standard sexual health practice. And I will leave it at that. I'll turn it back over to Terry.
Thank you, Peter. Well, we were going to do a case now, but I have a feeling that you might like to ask questions. Would you like to ask questions? Why don't we just do that? Because it seems like the three of us can answer your questions and might get some. If you have some cases, you can bring them up, or I have cases to kind of see how you do. But should we get some chairs around this little table? Maybe do that. Okay, as we're gathering, does somebody have a question? Yes. I think that's a really good question. Did you all hear it? What about suppression for people that have genital HSV1?
Yes.
My feeling is that that decision depends upon the same kinds of factors. Do they have a vulnerable partner? Do they have a partner who's negative for both type 1 and 2? And do they want to do it? I feel like since we know this is so safe, that their feelings about what they want should be really important. They could certainly transmit to a partner. Can we bring this over there, or what can we do? Can we bring this over there?
I think it's small enough, we can probably.
Okay.
Shot.
All right.
I can.
Oh. Okay. Great. Thank you.
I get to moderate.
You get it.
It's very exciting. Yes.
Okay. My question is, and this goes into your importance in counseling them also. Why is it important to know whether or not it's their first episode, especially serologically, because by the time you get the result back, it's too late to differentiate an episodic and primary therapy. But also, would it be more detrimental to a relationship to say, yes, this is your first episode, and you probably got it while you're with this person?
I don't know that it helps you from a health point of view, but a lot of people want to know if it's their first infection. Sometimes they want to know about going back and telling other partners that they may have infected them. I think it's just a matter of understanding it for some people. And it isn't too late. If you wait too long, it's too late. But if you draw the serology when they first present the symptoms, it's not too late.
How long does it take to get the Western blot back if it goes to Washington?
About 2 weeks.
Actually, I would comment that reiterate the very important mission that Terry said, which is that new appearance of Doug Hartley's in a relationship doesn't necessarily imply that either partner's had other partners. A person with, 40% of people who present clinically with this is the first time ever they've had anything like this, in fact, can be shown serologically to have been infected for some period of time. So some of those are the first symptomatic outbreak in someone who's had it all along. Again, there are no implications on infidelity in the relationship. Even when the infection is newly acquired, it is as often as not a partner who was chronically infected and didn't know. So again, now it's an STD, so you do want to talk to people, ideally both members of the couple with the other one not there, and learn what other exposures might have occurred. So don't ignore that aspect, but don't assume it. And the serological testing is critical often to understanding that, and that in turn can be critical to how couples relate to each other henceforth and forever.
So I'll plug Terry's book for her. The good news about the bad news, because I really think that there's good literature. Charlie is a wonderful writer and has great books as well. That we need to provide good information, and that's what really drives people wanting to know. And so I think when you have a counseling session, I sort of will ask people like, okay, do you really need to know this or not? And make sure they understand what the back history is around sort of misdiagnoses, as Hunter's talked about, or infections that were unrecognized. And many times people are fine. They say, well, all right, they assume that this means either that someone's going to think they've been unfaithful or their partner was unfaithful, and that's just not the case.
I think serologic testing can just elucidate so many things. If you come in with a person, first episode infection, let's say the serology is negative, swab test positive, they say, I haven't had another partner, and their husband, let's say, is accusing them of cheating on them. If you can get him in to draw him and find if he's positive, you can say, hey, if you guys have had sex with anybody else ever in your life, which most people, true virgins to marriage are kind of rare these days, then this could have been with you for a really long time. So I think it can really help sort out a lot of issues within a relationship, as Hunter said. And it's really important that you offer, I think, that to both partners.
Over here, I know there are a lot of people. Yeah, David.
Thanks. This is great. I learned a lot from it. I have two questions. One is to be clear about what you mean by this serology testing in the early diagnosis. Is it herpes select, or because you may have mentioned not to use IgMs?
No, IgMs, just herpes select. IgG type specific. Got it. Herpes select is a brand name,
right.
But it's a kind of ELISA test that looks for IgG only.
There is an interesting and, in my mind, great uncertainty. The herpes select is the only assay that has been systematically studied for this whole business about gray zone results. What's it mean, and what the false positive rates between the manufacturer's recommended cutoff level and higher levels like 3 or 3.0. That's only the set of herpes select. Now, the biology of the test is such that most people think it probably is valid for the CAPTIA test. The others, it's wild guesswork. There simply is no way to be certain. So it is a problem. So there is an advantage to perhaps relying mostly on those two assays, just because we have a better handle on how to interpret them. And the other point I'll make about the IgM, since it came up, is it's interesting if you ask laboratory folks. Anybody here who's primarily a laboratorian? Okay, So it's interesting to ask the question, why do you still offer this test that we know works so lousy? Well, A, they've been marketed, they don't know it doesn't work that way. B, they will say, well, doctors keep ordering it. Well, doctors keep ordering it because the lab is sending them slips that have these pre-things checked off on. There's this vicious cycle. And third, it's a dirt cheap test to do with a high profit margin. And I don't believe that has no influence on people's offering this lousy test. It tends to be done semi-automatically, and it should be.
And I think the other thing is that clinicians have been taught that for other disease states, like Hep B and things, you can look at IgM and sort out whether it's new or old, and for herpes, you really can't. So I think it's also a lack of knowledge. But I think there's no question that this is an issue of profit.
But we'll come back to that, and I'll let you comment in a second. There's some skepticism, and I clinicians who don't like ordering a test unless they don't have quote unquote confidence. And you sort of miss that. For most people, it's not an issue. They either have an outbreak and they have positive serology, or their serology cutoffs are high enough in the focus that you can say, look, the positive predictive value is pretty high given the, either the population we're screening, like STD clinics, or the fact that their cutoff was high enough. But it's bizarre to me that we don't hear this about not ordering other tests like syphilis serology. You know, no one would say, well, we're not going to order an RPR because you have to do confirmatory testing. So I think it's this idea of like mental laziness in clinicians, the idea that like, if there's a gray zone, you do confirmation, and use this as a screen. It's that simple.
But guess what? It's different. Just there was a second point, sorry. What was different than the 2006 CDC guidelines is you're saying screen everyone, or you're promoting that?
I was saying that's my opinion. No, I'm not saying screen everyone. There was a whole list of people. I'm saying if you go as part of an STD screen, okay. If you ask patients, do you think that herpes is included in a full STD screen?
Yep.
The vast majority say yes. And you know, you put a speculum in a woman's vagina, she thinks you're testing her for everything. Certainly, if you go for an STD screen, you assume that the most prevalent STD in the U.S. is included.
Well, even then, people still don't understand that we can't look at their genitals and tell them they don't have herpes. So when you tell them you were fine or everything was negative, they assume that, including HIV, which is still bizarre to me, that people sort of don't understand that.
You obviously struck a nerve when you keep hammering on, but I'm going to say one other thing. Lost my train of thought. I'll come back.
Looking at genitals.
So there's a. let me first go. There's a woman in the back who's had her hand raised for a while, and then.
I had a question actually that relates very much to sort of the standard STD screen, and I'm wondering. So we live in Massachusetts where they're really moving to the primary care model and taking away STD clinics, and I'm wondering about reimbursement issues in your experience as private providers. You had listed different codes that practitioners can use, but none of those were basic screening. They were all symptomatic.
Well, V74.5 is an STD screen, and because it's a V code,
right.
Some insurance companies cover it and others don't, which is why if somebody comes in for an STD screen, it's always good to go, I'm sure you do, go through a list of symptoms. Do you have this, 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 or this? And even though people say, I'm just here for a screen, if you go through that list frequently, they'll say, oh yeah, I have that. And then you can code for it.
The point I was going to make is that screening is that the debates and uncertainties, and there are debates about the position of HSV2 serological screening, gets muddied because people don't think of the difference. They say screening, but screening, if you strictly define it, is we're going to test somebody who has no obvious clinical suspicion. And that's a very different thing than saying, I'm going to limit this test to people who have a reasonable starting point positive predictive value. They're the partner of an infected person. They've had unexplained symptoms. They've had multiple partners. There are other things. That becomes more diagnostic testing. Whether you call it screening or diagnosis, if you think of using a test primarily people who have a reasonable higher prior probability, epidemiologically, clinically, others, then the test in that setting is really very reliable. You don't have a whole lot of false positives, even if you disregard the difference between the manufacturer's cutoff index value and a higher one.
Thank you.
So distinguish in your mind, you're welcome, between screening and diagnosis and higher positive values, and don't hesitate to use the test in the latter scenario. Let the debate go on about true screening and whether that has a role in what population.
Would you agree, Hunter? Well, we may not agree about this, actually.
We may not.
Which is okay. Would you agree that if somebody presents for an STD screen, that herpes should be included?
Again, it's a higher prior probability issue. If someone says, I want STD screening, and you're dealing with a college sophomore who's had two lifetime sex partners, and I say no genital symptoms, I would hesitate to screen that person for HSV2. I would talk about the pros and cons, and then if he or she is still concerned, I might well go ahead, but I'd be really concerned about how I was going to interpret a mid-level index value.
Why couldn't you just confirm it?
and then just confirm. But are you going to recommend on a national scale that all such persons be tested, particularly if they don't have the symptoms allowed in the code? I'm not saying it's a clear, I'm not saying that I necessarily disagree. I think case by case, I'm not willing to bite the bullet personally in saying that all such persons should be screened as an automatic routine. I think there's an area of legitimate difference between the experts. Now I jump forward and I've got an African-American person who comes in and has had chlamydia twice and a handful of sexual partners. Sure, screening for HSV2 has got a high prior probability and a greater likelihood of a non-confusing test result. But none of these are absolutely black and white, always do it. A few of these are black and white, always do it, never do it in situations.
But what I would say about it is if you don't include herpes in an STD screen, I think you need to be very clear with patients that you didn't do it. Because they don't have a clue what to ask you. Some of them don't, some do. They count on you to know. And if you're not testing for herpes, then I think you need to be incredibly clear. And we put it in writing. When people deny, say, I don't want that, we write it out and we sign it. And we give them a little card and say, this is what you've had, da-da-da-da-da. And you call and you get the results on that da-da-da date. So that they know exactly what they've had done. So there's no question, if they go on to infect somebody with herpes, they don't come back to you and say, you know what, I came in for an STD screen because I wanted to know where I stood. I thought I got tested for everything. I had sex with this person and gave them herpes. Was I positive for herpes? And you say, oh, I didn't look for herpes. And they didn't know. I think from a medical legal point of view, that's a big deal.
And I think we could probably also agree, Terry, that there is a difference, and I won't go into describing how I would interpret it, but suing if someone comes in and says, I want STD screening, as opposed to someone who comes in for a routine health care visit for birth control refill and saying, okay, we're going to test you for it, we're going to do an STD screen on you at your instigation. And that's a different scenario. And most people who request STD screening probably ought to be offered everything, but told the pros and cons of which they should be done.
Do any of you know the cost difference between the PCR with typing versus just a standard culture? I know in my health department we just do the culture for cost reasons, and so I didn't know if you had any figures on that since that's the preferred.
It depends upon whether they bill you as the clinician or they bill the patient. So in my situation, I'll just give you my situation. We have the lab. Patients can pay at the time of service lab. People don't want to run through their insurance or be billed at home or whatever, so they may pay at the time of service. The lab bills us $30.50 for a PCR and $19.50 for a culture. We haven't done cultures in 6 or 7 years, but when we were doing it, that was the cost differential. However, if that patient gets billed by the lab because they were out of their deductible or something, the bill normally for the patient is around $200. So it sort of depends. I mean, clearly you know if they're billing us $30, they're making money from us too. So.
Yeah, and it depends on the venue. So University of North Carolina doesn't offer herpes cultures, period. So it's all PCR. So it is what it is. But like the state lab doesn't offer PCR, they only do culture.
I think the price of PCR is definitely coming down as it's more widely available.
Because our clinic is free to patients and we don't bill insurance or anything like that. So we would be absorbing all of that cost then.
And, you know, you really can negotiate good prices with big labs if you will send them a lot of samples. If you can look back and say, well, we did 50 herpes cultures in the past month, they're going to give you a great deal on the PCR versus two.
Did you have a question?
I have a question again about the HSV1 that is oral, though, and they don't have any genital symptoms at all. Now, do they need to be tested for serology also? Just confirm it. If they've got cold sores and they've had them all their life, then you know they have HSV1, right?
But remember that the person that has HSV1 first and acquires HSV2 is the person least likely to know that they have HSV2 because their HSV1 antibody keeps things under control. So if they want to know if they have genital herpes, I mean, you wouldn't need to look for type 1 if they have a lifetime of cold sores. But actually, if patients like order online, like HealthCheck USA, where they can order their own STD tests, if you order type 1 and 2 together, it's $100. If you just order 1 or 2, it's $80. So it's not that big of a question.
Yeah, I think what you're asking is, if they have a good history of cold sores, do you need to order HSV1 serology?
confirmed that it's due to HSV-1? No. So if clinical history of cold sores, it's HSV-1. If it is HSV-2, they have HSV-2 anyway in the genital tract almost always, and it's not going to be recurrent. So Terry's point is, you don't want to miss HSV-2. You want to order HSV-2 serology on those folks if you're screening them for genital herpes. But you don't need to do HSV-1 serology on them if they have a history of cold sores.
If they have a history of cold sores, then, and they have never had any genital ulcers ever, do you offer suppression for them, or do you even need to offer suppression for them?
I would say that it depends on their situation. If they're really bothered by their cold sores, we have a lot of people with suppression.
We suppress them.
Well, few people with oral or HSV-1 recurrent are ever going to get genital HSV-1.
Right.
There's a lot written about concern about auto-inoculation to other body parts. That auto-inoculation is almost entirely limited to people during the first infections. So during the first outbreak, people can get a herpetic whitlow or that sort of thing. Once the infection is established for a few months and the immune response is built, people don't auto-inoculate. If it happens, it's really rare. So if someone's HSV-1, has oral HSV-1 that has this childhood, they're never going to get genital. You're also probably immune to catching a new infection anywhere in your body with the same virus type. So they're never going to catch HSV-1 anywhere in their body again. It's going to be limited to oral, that's all they'll ever have.
Okay.
And they need suppressive therapy if they are one of those infrequent oral HSV-1s who's having particularly severe prolonged outbreaks or particularly frequent ones. Sure, they may benefit from suppression.
But what about spreading it to their partner?
So for suppression around sexual transmission of HSV-1 through oral sex?
Yes.
Simple answer is we don't have any data on it, so.
But I would say if you have a person that's positive for type 1 oral and they get negative cold sores, and they want to give oral sex to someone who's negative for both, I think it would be reasonable to go on suppression.
Okay.
But remember that half of the, on a statistical basis, half of the partners of such people are going to already be HSV-1 positive and therefore immune themselves.
So
that's a situation, but they may still test negative. So it's a, so there's, on the top of that, half the partners aren't going to be at risk anyway. But there are potential roles. Asymptomatic shedding of oral HSV-1 appears to be less common than genital shedding of genital HSV-2. So anecdotally, it seems an awful lot of HSV-1 oral transmissions occur from people who are having an active cold sore at the time.
Right.
It's not the case for genital, where most transmissions occur.
I'm at the University of Georgia, and we have lots of students that come in and they're worried about their cold sores.
Well, yeah, they have a lot of oral sex. Frankly, we just don't have honest discussions around it, and this is something that really should be probably talked about and written about more extensively, including more studies around this, because there's sort of a lack of data.
Mm-hmm.
You can read more about skiers getting cold sores than you can about people transmitting it sexually, and what are we going to do about it? So I think it's a real conundrum. The good part is that the drugs are pretty safe. So if you decide with counseling to put someone on suppression around that, probably no harm done. But I don't think we really fully understand what to exactly counsel someone. Should they be disclosing they have a cold sore before they have sex with someone? It's really murky. And we can get into personal opinions, but there's no data.
But they ask us all those questions.
Oh, yeah, it's a big deal. I just think we don't, oral sex is sort of this taboo thing, both in academic settings and certainly from a public health policy standpoint. We just don't like talking about it.
Thank you. Hi, I really enjoyed this today. Thank you so much. I'm at an STD clinic in Rochester, and my patients are very anxious when they have a new outbreak, of course, of herpes. And when I'm diagnosing that new outbreak, I just want to understand that asymptomatic shedding, which is 70%, how much of a time does that occur? Like, is it a year or 2 years?
The 70% is the percent of transmission that's due to asymptomatic shedding versus active outbreaks at the time of transmission.
Okay.
And it goes on over people's lifetime. It doesn't just stop after a year.
And everybody has some asymptomatic shedding. If you have HSV-2, then if you have positive blood tests, that's truly positive, that can take into account the vagaries of a hard interpret test. They have periods of time when the virus is present in and around their genitals without symptoms. It could be be from as little as 1 or 2% of the days over the course of the year, but it's probably rarely that, to as much as 20 or 30%. It's higher in the first few months after acquiring the infection than it is later. There may be a gradual decrement over time. I think there are reasons to believe that the studies may have some bias in terms of who gets followed for that long to begin with. But to some extent, it's there forever. My wife spent part of her professional career in senior services and senior healthcare issues, and she used to talk to me about this is the STD we are all carrying into our aging years, along with age, some HPV infection, and she's right.
And along with that, when you look at the NPAIDS data, you need to remember that it's 14 to 49. But think of all the people over 49 who have herpes, and those people are continuing with their sexualities with drugs for erection issues and alternatives. So I think that NPAIDS number, though it's really interesting, is an underestimate in terms of people having sex.
Although I would ask you, my impression is, and this is one of the reasons why we need better research than we have, anecdotally, it seems to be uncommon to find 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds coming in with new genital herpes, or someone who is still having outbreaks, say, 4 or 5 times a year at age 50 compared to when they first got the infection at age 25. So when the data show that the infection persists in symptomatic form and asymptomatic shedding persists for a long time, I have this cognitive dissonance about what I think I see in the real world. And we certainly need data.